The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. Before beginning our program, we would like to invite you to sign up for a free trial subscription to one of our publications at irei.com. Whether you are interested in real estate, infrastructure, or real assets in general, IREI has a publication to suit your needs. Select Publications on the main menu to choose a publication. Interested in more than one? Sign up for them all.
Hello, and thank you for joining the program. I'm your host, Mike Consul. You are about to hear from Brian Nelson, founder and president of NB Private Capital, one of the major players in the red-hot student housing space. Like so many other sectors of our economy, student housing has been hit by the coronavirus pandemic and the partial economic shutdown, including colleges and universities sending their students home to do their coursework remotely to help ensure that they maintain the kind of social distancing from one another that hopefully will short-circuit this pandemic. But that has raised some questions, such as how has the student housing space been affected by it? How will student housing rebound from this? What are the demographics telling us about the longer-term future of student housing? For instance, what do demographics say about college enrollment and occupancy of student housing developments into the future, 5 and 10 and 15 years down the road? And what are the biggest short-term and long-term concerns of the student housing space? Brian Nelson joins the program to answer those and other questions. Here is that conversation. Brian Nelson, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mike. Really appreciate the opportunity.
So let's talk about how the student housing sector is being affected right now during the coronavirus pandemic. Now that students have been sent home and they're not occupying the housing that their parents have paid for, or maybe some of them are. I don't know whether some maybe are staying in the facilities. What are you seeing out there, though, with the pandemic and students being told go home and learn remotely?
Right. We are seeing all of the above. So you have several factors at play. First, there is more pushback than we've ever had on current rents. If you're familiar with the student housing model, typically now in most tight markets, 12-month leases are required. So even when the students in a normal year, when the students go home for the summer, we're still collecting, and we usually collect typically 96% plus during the summer. So it's never really been a big issue for us. And then during the summer, we're usually about 40% or occupied. Those are people just, they're finishing up a degree or doing some work over the summer. So we have about 60% of the students go home. Right now, as we speak, in the middle of this pandemic, we're collecting about 80% of what we've been. So about 80% of what we were collecting in February before things started to slow down. So we're still collecting pretty well, considering, a little bit better than we had anticipated, but there's still about a 20% delinquency. What we've seen, though, in the last couple of weeks of May is as schools have started to announce that they were going to open up, we've been collecting a lot more of those delinquents. We may go up to 84-85% after all is said and done. But what's interesting is we're about 60% physically occupied, which is, a little bit better than just normal summer. And part of that is because students have had it being at home with their parents, or maybe their parents have had it with them. But we're seeing a lot more students on campus or around campus, I should say, in their apartments. And I think a lot of them are just, they're looking at their summer plans and whether they're planning to travel to Europe or work for have an internship or just work to save money. All of those plans have been scrapped. So why not just advance your degree and work online and be close to school?
Interesting. So let me ask you about the contracts that these parents sign. Do they have the force majeure clause? In other words, in the case of an act of God, which I suppose you could debate whether the coronavirus is an act of God, but in the event of some act of nature or act of God, we're not on the hook for this. Is that part of the contract? This might be an area you don't want to get into. You don't want to give people necessarily ammunition for saying, hey, look, I have this escape hatch.
But is that written into those contracts?
Typically, no. And it's really difficult because nobody really anticipates a school closure. But it's one of those where, it's very difficult to get out of the contracts. Mom and dad have signed it typically. Most of the parents own homes. It's what we like about student housing. You have very fantastic economic tenants. And they understand how credit works. But part of it is just the model, the market. Students really, a lot of them are going back and forth between home and school right now. Think about graduation programs and graduation ceremonies and things like that. They're coming back and forth to campus quite a bit. So a lot of people like to have that place to stay. So if they're using it, there's really minimal argument. There's a handful of people who may have lost their job with the school, and that was helping fund. Those people have a little bit better case. At the same time, really, most of these kids, students, were still going to school. They were still finishing their coursework online. The semester finished just as anticipated. So it's really hard for them to make that case. And since most of them have been occupying the property, it hasn't been a big issue for us outside of maybe that 15 to 20% that I spoke of earlier.
So we'll get out of this black swan situation in just a minute, but I one more question just about the current situation. When you do get pushback from parents, are they asking for rent relief, for instance, a reduction in it? Or are they saying my child is not occupying the property, so therefore I really don't want to pay? Or what's kind of their argument, or what kind of relief are they looking for?
Yeah, well, they don't really say much. They kind of go into hiding and make you come chase them. But I will tell you one thing, and that's what I mean when schools have started to announce, which has really happened the last week or two, has really changed the whole dynamic for the student housing the student housing asset model. Now that schools are announcing that they're going to open doors, they're going to have physical classrooms, you're starting to see people wake up and say, "Oh, okay, well, look, I got to figure out where I'm going to live. Maybe I'll make good on what I owe." And now that the economy is starting to come back in certain markets, you're starting to see a lot of schools open up. Most of our portfolio tends to be in red states that have been a little bit more proactive opening up. So you're starting to see parents running out of excuses and just coming back and paying rent. And that's why we actually have better collections at the end of May and beginning of June than we did at the beginning of May, which is a really interesting prospect. I haven't really ever seen that before.
So student housing has been a really hot real estate niche for quite a while now. What constitutes student housing when they're housed off of campus with regard to proximity? In other words, what is the farthest a student housing project can be located from a campus and still achieve optimal occupancy and financial performance?
Great question. It really heavily depends on the market. Most students, approximately 7 out of 10, are going to look at proximity to campus as the number one attribute they look at when they're considering student housing. We're seeing a pretty interesting movement where more and more students are going to school without a car. And you just think about the logistics, insurance and having a car. But with technologies like Uber and electronic scooters and electronic cars, it makes a lot more sense to not come with a car. And universities certainly all have parking issues, almost all of them. In some cases, some of the larger cities are concerned about traffic near the university. So you're starting to see the universities, the cities, and the parents really push back on owning a car. Well, that makes a big difference to the student because now driving to campus isn't really an option. It really is about walking distance. So I would say for markets like that, especially big city markets, you want to be within half a block or half a mile at the farthest. But typically 3 to 4 blocks is where we start seeing students willing to pay a premium. And once you get that 4 or 5 blocks away, you start to see a little bit rental rates go down. And then once you're past half a mile, between half a mile to a mile, that's where you're still considered student housing. Anything above a mile, even if it's student dedicated, you're going to have some issues, in my opinion. Some markets are a little bit more commuter oriented. some schools, you have to drive to get there just because of the landscape, topography. In that case, you know, location isn't quite as much of a distinguishing factor, because if one property's a mile and a half away and the next property's 2 miles away, you know, that might be an extra minute or two if they're driving. So I think you're going to see a little bit more of the market separate themselves into what's a walking school market, what's a driving school market, and what's an alternative like buses and shuttles and things like that. And you'll see proximity really matter within half a mile in the first two.
Okay, so proximity is critical. So besides proximity, Brian, name two or three amenities or factors that seal the deal when you're trying to land those student tenants.
Well, for me, it's all about who your target market is for an individual property. If you're at a school where you're predominantly middle-class students, value, then combination of value and location, and then having all of the core amenities. Most students like things like washer and dryers in their units. That's a big deal. They get the privacy of doing their own laundry. They don't have to share it with somebody else or a large group, or have to keep coming back to take their clothes out of the washer and then put it in the dryer. The Wi-Fi is huge right now. Students stream everything, especially with more and more classes online, or this coming fall where you're going to have more of an online component. So that's going to be exceptionally critical. If you can imagine 400 students in a community all using Wi-Fi or YouTube at the same time, those are elements that are absolute must-haves. We're seeing a lot of kids, though, because they spend so much screen time, that the social community aspect is very important to them. So we're seeing that as a way you can differentiate yourself, is just by having fun activities, getting students together. But one thing I will add that I suspect that we're starting to see is the smaller unit mix, the one and two bedroom units with bed to bath parity. I think in a post-COVID world, you're going to see parents want to have more and more privacy with fewer roommates and fewer interactions. In fact, I think a lot of the dorms, a lot of the universities that have students sharing dorm rooms, they're going to move away from that because they think it might present a liability for them. And we're going to see more dorms just have one student. And in that case, there's actually a lot of talk right now in the student housing world that universities are going to have substantially less or fewer dorm capacity, and you're going to reach out to the private market to house a lot of the freshmen because they want to have this bed, one student per bedroom.
You know, my experience, Brian, when I was in college, because I started off in a dormitory before moving off campus into an apartment. This is before the era of off-campus student housing, really. Being put in a room with another person, you have two different lifestyles. You have two different sleeping patterns. And right. Every year, what I would see is a lot of students changing, like, hey, would you like to room with me instead of the guy I got in the room now? Because it caused a lot of conflict. I can understand why any student, let alone parents, would want their – and now there's new considerations with things like health and welfare, but that was a real pain. Let me get back to Wi-Fi. You mentioned Wi-Fi. Do you, at these properties, does a typical student housing development use your garden variety Wi-Fi supplier, somebody like Comcast or AT&T, or is there some higher level of provider, or do you use repeaters on the property, these devices that amplify the signal or keep the signal strong throughout the entire facility? Because as you were talking about, I mean, students are such big users of Wi-Fi, but they also use it differently than a lot of adults, and that they're downloading a lot of material, they're streaming lots of stuff, they're into online video games and whatnot. So what do you do to make that Wi-Fi stronger and bulletproof?
Well, that's a big challenge, and a lot of it depends on the properties. A lot of the newer properties will have really fantastic technology. It's a lot easier to get up to the speeds that you want and the breadth that you want. A lot of the older properties don't have that infrastructure, and so and a lot of it's very market specific. Some markets it's very easy to adapt that type of technology. We've used all of the above, everything you described. It just depends. And inherently, when we buy, sometimes we'll buy an older property. And we're buying it because it has a fantastic location. and mom and dad who've owned it, or mom and pop who've owned it, haven't put a dime into it. And in some cases, we've seen properties that, that they check the box for Wi-Fi, but if one person's on it upstairs, forget it. And that becomes a really big challenge. And I'll tell you this, Mike, I don't know that we have a solution that's worked across the board. We tried a number of different things that have worked exceptionally well, and we've had some things that have struggled. And so I think there's an opportunity there for us, and something that we've been working on with some national vendors is, what is there a plug and play system that kind of one size fits all, that we could just plug into our 40 unit property through our 400 unit property and immediately amp up at the individual level, or whether it's specific buildings or specific units, and get us to a level where we could use this as a competitive advantage. In some markets, it's worked really well. Other markets, we've had a tough time.
So who makes the final decision when it comes to, you're meeting with the parents in your meeting, or your people are meeting with the parents and meeting with the student, they tour the property. Who makes the final decision? Is it the student? Does the mom ultimately make the decision? Is it the dad or the parents jointly? How does that conclude? Is there a really kind of a common theme here where there's a particular person who makes the final decision?
Yeah, there's so many variables. It's just like any family unit. I'd say typically the students will make the decision on their own, but they'll always want the higher price, nicer project. But most of them will usually go into a situation with two or three other roommates. Not always, but in many cases, in that case, mom and dad are they're just going to make sure, okay, daughter's chosen this one, or son, let's just make sure it checks all the boxes that are important to us. One thing that's really important to us is we believe security is increasingly more critical, especially for female students and especially for dad. You want to check off both those boxes. You can even buy an older property and introduce, just some modest security technology to make them feel a lot better, certainly a lot safer than what they were before. That becomes a big box checker. But mom typically will want things that are more conducive for the academics, and then that's where closer to campus. That's where we have a lot of community activities that are focused on grades and things like that. But study rooms and places where if there's three or four roommates, the daughter can go in or the son and study on their own, have their own little space. That becomes real important to them too. So there's a lot of hot buttons, but typically the parents are going to focus on security, proximity, and what's the most conducive for good academics, where the student usually goes in with their friends or looking for the social environment. But definitely something that I think that if the students are involved, that bed-to-bath parity is one of the biggest ones. And I think mom and dad now post-COVID are going to follow through with that. In fact, it's to a point where we have a property that has about 200 units that are four-bedroom, two-bath. And our market research says, we're going to make a lot more money if we convert that fourth bedroom into a third bathroom. So we have three bedrooms, three bathrooms. And while we're doing that, we build in some just better sanitization technology, go in with a really high-tech bathroom and really focus on that experience. But that's something I think it's going to change a little bit in the market going forward.
What is a high-tech bathroom?
Well, it's all about the experience, right? So you could have LED lighting it's great. It gives you a lot of different perspectives in lighting. It gives mood settings. You could, you want to wake up and take a shower with a pink or blue or a mixture of different moods for the lighting. You could have Bluetooth-enabled headphones so you can listen to your shower playlist while you're showering. towel racks that are heated if it's a colder climate, just things like that it makes the experience a little bit better. They could probably figure it out on their own with their own technology. They could bring in their own speakers and things like that. But it's just cool. It's unique. And we're just rethinking the experience. And, that's just small things. And if it can give you a competitive advantage, then you push it.
Brian, you are spoiling these kids. You're kind of blowing out of the water my next question, which was, what's the argument for off-campus student housing at all when – campus dormitories are at so many colleges and universities, or has that changed since the big era of student off-campus housing has come along? Are more and more colleges and universities just saying, look, why are we in the business of housing the students? Let's just get out of this business entirely. We'll start to close down some of these dormitories. And maybe they're a little bit landlocked and decide we need that property anyway to build build an education building or what have you. Because I can see students arguing with their parents about wanting to be in a student housing where, wow, they've got high-tech bathrooms, I've got my own laundry facility, versus being on campus, a lower budget environment, and that argument could take place. What is the argument for going with student housing off campus rather than your standard dormitory on campus?
Yeah, great question. I think what's changed the most over the last 20 years maybe has been parents' attitudes towards students. You referenced it earlier, back when you and I went to school, you know, we just needed a place to live. I mean, I lived on a futon that also converted into a couch in the size of space that's like a walk-in closet for some of these students today. But a lot of it's just mom and dad, and maybe mom and dad had children older, maybe they have fewer children, maybe the grandparents with the baby boomers, as wealthy as they are compared to their grandparents, are more involved. There's more money being spent on education and more money available. And a lot of it is just parents, you know, this is our farewell. We want to make sure our son or daughter has that great experience. And that's a big driver. The schools are way behind the game in providing that experience. But frankly, most of the students don't want Big Brother. They'll go to, you know, typically live on campus for the freshman year. I think that's really common. And then as soon as they're done with that, they've met their friends, they know who they want to hang out with, and from there they want to get, typically, not always, but they typically want to get away from that as quickly as they can and be on their own. But a second part of that that we've seen change, and just put yourself in the shoes of a university administrator or a university president. You're right, Mike. You want to build your academic prowess. You don't necessarily want to take your funding and build new housing, especially with something like COVID. You look at another experience where that could present some liability to the university. So you're seeing a mix. You're seeing some universities housing more of their students, especially markets like USC, where they're really concerned about the safety of students in the general community. So they're going to try to bring them on campus where they feel like they could do a better job of protecting them. And then you're seeing other universities where schools, frankly, just aren't that interested in dorms. Utah Valley University, 35 to 40,000 students, and they have no interest in dorms right now. But why would universities still keep the dorm system? It's tradition. But again, you look at what university presidents are looking for, and there is a correlation with graduation rates. You know, how many of your freshmen come in and end up graduating? And that's a real big metric for the university presidents. And there is a strong correlation between students who live on campus their freshman year and end up graduating. And just think about the logic that the person living on campus, they're going to have built-in friends. They're going to typically go to the football games and basketball games. They're going to be more involved in their studies. And overall, school becomes front and center because they live right there on campus. And they just keep that same loyalty, that same school pride, and that same drive when they go into the off-campus student housing. So those are some of the factors that play into that.
So what are the demographics telling you about the future of college enrollment? U.S. birth rates are down, after all, and so is the flow of immigrants into the United States. So you must be looking ahead at all times and thinking in terms of how many, you know, it's generation to generation, but how many students are going to be coming into the pipeline, and what is the future foretell, or at least the trends foretell in terms of demographics? What are those demographics telling you right now, Brian?
Yeah, just the opposite. You're still seeing that the general long-term picture demographics slightly slow down, but you look at the international world and the premium placed on a U.S.-based education. So many countries want to send their best and the brightest to the United States, even if they end up going back. And so even if immigration is down, for example, you're still going to see students get their visas and have the ability to finish their degrees here. Universities push for it. The international component is very important to them. But you're also seeing a substantially higher percentage of high school graduates pursuing education. Right now, about 74% of high school graduates today in the United States will go on and do some form of college. That's up from about less than 50% 30 years ago. So it's changed. And even though tuition has gone up, but obviously that's been a function of the market and the strong demand, you see really strong data points that still point to education being really strong after high school. One of them, Wall Street Journal just produced something really interesting column about a month ago talking about unemployment rates. And those who are college educated, their unemployment is a third of what it is for those who have less than a high school diploma during hard times. So you look at the Great Recession, 2009, 2010, if you had a college degree, your unemployment was somewhere between 4 to 5%, where in some of the other demographics, those who had some college or those who just graduated high school were almost double. So you're seeing on the downside protection, there's a lot of logic in having a college degree. And then, of course, when you accumulate what the difference in income over a lifetime of over a career, whether you have a college degree or not, is now a $1 million decision. And people get that. And so that's why the ROIs associated with getting a degree are really strong. I think where you're going to see pushback is going to be market-based. I think you're going to see expensive liberal arts schools and things of that nature that don't have as compelling of an ROI. I think you're going to see them make cutbacks. I think you're going to see a lot of the regional universities and some of the states that are losing population slow down, or lose funding. And you're going to see a lot of those universities try to consolidate. So, you know, West Virginia is a really good example where I'd expect about 4 or 5 regional schools to be closed down in the next few years, and they're going to try to push more and more students to West Virginia University and try to add capacity there. So you're going to see a few movements, but overall, I think college is very healthy. And I think it's just the value of that degree is irreplaceable right now in an increasingly global competitive economy.
So what about the trend towards remote learning? we're seeing that in a big way right now because of the coronavirus pandemic. There are people who sometimes think that, you know, once you break, you untether from the actual physical campus, there are people who are going to say, you know, I can learn very well remotely. I can do it less expensively and so on and so forth. Is that a threat at all? Students learning via computer and from their bedrooms or living rooms. How significant a trend is it and how big a threat do you consider it?
I think that's a great question. And it's for certainly people who are worried in the retail world where you're seeing Amazon completely change the landscape of that space and how it impacts commercial real estate and the retail side. And so a lot of people naturally have been afraid of that. The University of Phoenix is and those that make online degrees available. It was something that maybe 15 to 20 years ago, the big institutional market, the REITs, were a little bit hesitant to get into student housing for that reason. But it's fleshed its way out in a way that I don't think even the diehards expected it to, especially the pandemic. Here you have students that essentially finished this last semester online, not going to the classes, and they may have enjoyed it for the first week or two. But after a couple of weeks of sheltering in place, they were protesting it. The University of Dayton had protests of students demanding to go back to school. And you see a lot of the right now, today, a lot of schools are announcing plans to open classrooms, even though, you know, we're not quite sure if there's a resurgence of the pandemic. We don't really know where we are, what the inning of the score is. And, of course, the protests have changed a lot of the COVID dynamic. We don't know what's at play. But universities are opening up anyway, and the big driving force behind that is students. They want to get back to school. They want to have physical classrooms. They want that college experience. And a lot of people say, yeah, but you can get your degree online, and it's very, really convenient. And today's Generation Z is very high-tech. And the answer is no way. Picture middle class to upper middle class or affluent parents with an 18-year-old high school graduate. Could you really picture them going to their son or daughter and saying, hey, we want you to stay in your room. get your degree online. Maybe you can work at Taco Bell while you're getting your degree. It's not happening. It's a rite of passage. Mom and dad want the son or daughter out of the house. The son or daughter wants to be out of the house. They want to move on. They want to have that experience. Recruiters prefer it because it shows that the students have the maturity to live on their own, go to classes, figure out their coursework, how to graduate. There's so much to it that we just don't see it going away. In fact, more and more students, I think, are really valuing the physical classroom post-pandemic. Now that they've experienced online, they didn't like it.
Yeah, well, I can tell you from personal experience. I mean, I graduated, and then later on, I did a couple of online courses learn a couple of skills. I absolutely hated the online stuff. I love being in the classroom. I mean, it's just really difficult or impossible to have a real discussion online. And I really don't see it as much of a threat, but I did want to get your perspective on that. How many properties does NB Private Capital own right now? How many student housing properties?
About 30. So we're under contract for our 31st and our 32nd right now at Clemson. And Notre Dame, so in a pretty big portfolio.
And how many you're looking to acquire more? I take it either acquire more or build more. Where do you see the company in 5 or 10 years?
Well, it's hard to say. You know, with student housing, the landscape has changed so much just in the last 5 or 6 years, as you've seen a really strong demand on the institutional investor side. And also on investor side, as they become more familiar with the category and the category has performed, we don't really know how it's going to perform post-COVID. You know, the student housing sector had one of the best runs during the recession, and that's been a big driving force to the success it's had over the last 10 years. And we'll see, you know, is it pandemic proof? Is this something that shows a vulnerability to student housing? You know, we're not sure. You know, collections, like I said, have been down. You know, we've had about the 15 to 20% delinquents since the school closure. That's not ideal. And then we'll see how we enroll, how we lease for this fall. I think will be a really good indicator of how successful this category is. From our standpoint, if we continue to perform well, you know, then that's the sky's the limit. You should have a good performance in the investment world, and you show a good model for understanding certain markets and the pricing and positioning of certain properties. If you execute on that strategy, you know, that's where I see us getting a little bit more financial backing and maybe looking to start a REIT or merging with a REIT or selling a big piece of the portfolio to large institutional investors if we start seeing the sector die out. But for right now, we're really bullish on our current model, this balance of finding old, ugly properties and improving them and modernizing them, along with buying just really nice, well-located core properties and hold it for the income. But overall, I think the market's going to be healthy if it rebounds here, because so many of today's retirees are looking for cash flow and stability that's not tied to economic cycles. And student housing so far has been able to produce that and execute on it at a level that a lot of other investments haven't been.
So the space, no doubt, it looks very solid. But let's wrap this up by having you talk about what your biggest student housing concern is for the short term, and maybe the long term. Maybe you have a chief short term concern and then a different long term concern. What would you say to that, Brian?
Well, short term right now, it's all about the pandemic. Schools haven't, a lot of students haven't known whether or not the schools will open. And as a result, they've been really reluctant to sign up for leasing. So what happens is typically you have this leasing window where if you know school's going to start in the fall, you know, September 2020, you have really starting from November of 2019 all the way through the fall of 2020 to lease up a property. And with the pandemic and ambiguity as to whether or not the schools would open, you're seeing a lot of students delay that. And then you're seeing a lot of these universities going, hey, wait a second, when flu season opens, we might have a resurgence. So we're seeing Notre Dame, a lot of these other schools that are opening their doors have actually advanced opening of school by a couple of weeks. So they're opening in mid-August as opposed to early September. So what's happening is you're shortening the window on both sides of that. And my fear in the near term is that you have this mad dash where instead of having a 10-month period where you lease up, you have you and all of your competitive set leasing up and deciding your fiscal year, the 2020-21 school year, is all decided in a 6 to 7 week period of leasing. And in that case, I'm worried that it gets cutthroat. And it's really hard if you throw a lot of concessions and you're competing with each other. And sometimes that's hard for a market to rebound because then that process tends to stay there the next year as kids are used to getting really good discounts and things like that. That scares me to death. I don't think that's going to happen because most of the markets we're in are very tight. In tight markets, most owners tend to be very patient and let it play out. But we'll see. That's something that really scares me to death in the near term.
Any long-term concerns? Is there anything out there on the horizon that may not even have presented itself yet, but you suspect it could come along, or it doesn't appear to be clear sailing if we get past the COVID period?
Yeah, long-term is, you know, the debt is still pretty cheap out there, and there's a lot of companies that love to develop student housing. And you know, as long as students have this preference for brand new, you might continue to see this rash of development, even in markets that can't absorb it. And that's probably my biggest concern for markets is you might have a market that's very stable, and then you could have four or five, six developers just come in, decide to come in the market and just build. And then they're building brand new and competing against each other. So they're throwing out concessions to get leased up. And it completely disrupts and challenges the market, and properties that have been stable for 20 plus years now all of a sudden are looking at survival techniques. And that's something I always worry about. And so you look, you know, how do you prevent that? Well, in some cases, it's just difficult. You want markets where it's where there are substantial barriers to entry. You want markets that where there are no plots of land, so it has to be 2, 3, 4 miles away. But that's probably the biggest challenge, in my opinion, isn't the one or two new developments. It's when you have 4 to 6 developments in a market that's not seeing that type of enrollment growth in a 1 to 3 year period, and it completely changes the market.
Yeah, overbuilt markets are the bane of real estate, no question about it.
Yes.
Our guest has been Brian Nelson, president and founder of NB Private Capital, a student housing investment company, major player in the student housing market, which has performed tremendously well for quite a period of time now. Now dealing with the coronavirus pandemic, but other than that, it looks like times may be good, Brian. Thanks a lot for taking the time and visiting with us.
It's a pleasure, Mike. Really appreciate it.